Dreams of God and of Gold, not necessarily in that order, made America possible. The First Charter of Virginia, the 1606 document that authorized the founding of Jamestown, is 3,805 words long. 98 of them are about carrying religion to such people as yet live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the true knowledge and worship of God. The other 3,707 words in the Charter concern the taking of all the lands, woods, soil, grounds, havens, ports, rivers, mines, minerals, marshes, waters, fishings, commodities, as well as orders to dig, mine, and search for all manner of mines of gold, silver, and copper. Explorers in the 16th and 17th centuries sought riches. Religious dissenters came seeking freedom of worship. In 1630, the Puritan John Winthrop, who crossed a stormy Atlantic aboard the Arbella, wrote a sermon, a model of Christian charity, that explicitly linked the New World to a religious vision of a New Jerusalem. "For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill," Winthrop said, drawing on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Forever shrewd about visuals, Ronald Reagan added the adjective shining to the image several centuries later. We've always lived with and perpetuated fundamental contradictions. In 1619, a Dutch man of war brought about 20 captive Africans, Negars, to Virginia, the first chapter in the saga of American slavery. European settlers, meanwhile, set about removing Native American populations, setting in motion a tragic chain of events that culminated in the Trail of Tears. And so, while whites built and dreamed, people of color were subjugated and exploited by a rising nation that prided itself on the expansion of liberty. Those twin tragedies shaped us then and ever after. As did basic facts of geography. There was a breathtaking amount of room to run in the New World. The vastness of the continent, the wondrous frontier, the staggering natural resources. These, combined with a formidable American work ethic, made the pursuit of wealth and happiness more than a full-time proposition. It was a consuming, all-enveloping one. For many, birth mattered less than it ever had before. Entitled aristocracies crumbled before natural ones. If you were a white man and willing to work, you stood a chance of transcending the circumstances of your father and his father's father, and of joining the great company of enterprising and self-made men, as Henry Clay put it in 1832. The next year, President Andrew Jackson appointed one such man to be postmaster of Salem, Illinois. Though a Whig at the time, Jackson was a Democrat, Abraham Lincoln was happy to accept. Lincoln's rise from frontier origins became both fable and staple in the American narrative. He understood the power of his story, for he knew that he embodied broad American hopes. "I happen, temporarily, to occupy this big White House," Lincoln told the 166th Ohio Regiment in the summer of 1864. "I am a living witness that any one of your children may look to come here as my father's child has." No understanding of American life and politics is possible without a sense of the mysterious dynamic between the presidency and the people at large. Sundry economic, geographic, and demographic forces, of course, shape the nation. Among these is an unspoken commerce involving the most ancient of institutions, a powerful chief, and the more modern of realities, a free, disputatious populace. In moments when public life feels unsatisfactory, then, it's instructive, even necessary, to remember first principles. What can the presidency be at its best? And how should the people understand their own political role and responsibilities in what Jefferson called the course of human events? In the beginning, at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, the presidency was a work in progress. Ambivalent about executive authority, many of the framers were nevertheless anxious to rescue the tottering American nation.